Hello, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, though today it really is just two of us. I'm Shireen.
There's no center aisle right now.
Not just yet. I'm Shireen Gourvani on the left, and
John Dougal on the right.
Hey, and listeners, we're so glad you're tuning in. So much is happening on the national level. We've got announcements of indictments. We've got protests for unions happening, strikes happening across this country. We have the announcement of a climate court, and we've got a looming government shutdown along with another Republican debate. What do you want to talk about, John?
Let's talk about the looming federal shutdown, which isn't really a shutdown. Somebody described it more as a brownout.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because a lot of it still keeps functioning, even if you don't have a budget.
That's true. So this is, I think, a concerning sign that we continue to have a pretty broken Washington, D.C.
Which is something we agree on.
We agree on. I also think we agree that generally, these shutdowns, we know that they're bad for the economy. They are very expensive, ultimately.
They don't save money. In my mind, if we shut down, you should save money. And no,
it
unfortunately,
doesn't.
The government seems to spend more when it, quote unquote, shuts down.
And why is that?
Well, because even those employees that are furloughed usually get back pay. So they didn't work, but then they get paid. There was other activities that took place as a result of, quote unquote, shutting down, you know, putting barricades around monuments and other things that you don't normally do, so you incur extra costs. And so it's just a sad commentary that, from my perspective, even the federal government can't properly shut itself down.
Yeah. So, but let's talk about why we're at this moment. So there was a deal that was worked out between Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House, and the Biden administration on spending levels that would go into this cycle to really set the budget moving forward. It's a continuing resolution, correct? Because we're not actually doing a budget. We don't do budget processes anymore.
And this is one of the deals that was set with Speaker McCarthy and a certain faction of Republicans in his caucus to say, we want to go back to normal order, regular business. We want to get away from these continuing resolutions. We want, I think it's 12 budget bills. We want to vote on each of them separately. We want the normal process to be restored. It hasn't existed for, I don't know, a couple decades now.
That's
but
right.
We want to go back to regular business. And right now, their concern is we're not going back to regular business.
Right.
Now, they want a few other things in there as well, some concessions about what is the total amount these bills are going to add up to so we can see the bottom line number, if you will, and other dynamics like that. And because he's got such a slim majority that if you just lose a few votes there, it really makes it difficult to get something passed with just the majority.
So this is really being driven by, as you are describing, quite a bit of infighting and tensions inside the Republican Party. And I guess I'm wondering, how do you think people should make sense of what is going on inside of this Republican Party that's saying, we want to lead, we want the presidency again, we want the Senate again, but we can't seem to see unity even in the House on a pretty regular process? How do you think listeners should make sense of what's going on in Washington with Republicans?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I think you have to understand there's merit to both sides, you know, in the Republican Party on this thing. There's merit to those that are saying, we want to go back to regular business, we want to know how much we're voting on, we want to see the big picture, and we want more fiscal responsibility. Because, you know, the amount of ballooning debt, we're over $33 trillion in debt, and that doesn't even count unfunded liabilities that are there. We need to bring some fiscal sanity to D.C. So there's a lot of merit to those arguments. On the other side, though, folks are saying, gee, if we shut down now, we're going to get a black eye. We're not going to be able to govern. We're going to lose any power that we have right now. We got to limp along and make things do while we try and get to that
better process. Yeah. And I mean, what I hear Speaker McCarthy saying, right, is that there are members of his own party that are really trying to blow the whole thing up. And it feels like a really frustrating moment. And as you're suggesting, a very thin margin that he has to work with to get this done.
And those that are, quote unquote, wanting to blow it up are feeling like he lied to them.
Right.
You said we're going to go back to normal business, and we're not. Here we are, you know, days before, quote unquote, this looming end of the budget, and we're not back to normal process.
Right. So, I mean, many things to consider here.
Chris Stewart
resigned. So he just
September 15th. So you take that small sliver and
make
just
it even
subtract
smaller.
One more.
Yeah, that's right. So I just want to put into kind of plain language what this means for people. So this would mean that individuals in our military would not be receiving paychecks. People who are at border security would likely receive back pay, but for
the
moment, right? Not. And then we also are talking about people who may be on WIC, so supplemental nutrition programs that we have, would potentially show up at a grocery store and be turned away. The funding for those kinds of programs would also be cut. That's about 40,000, I think, people in Utah, women, infants, and children that are on a program like that. These are very real consequences for people that I think are difficult for your average person to understand why we're seeing this kind of partisan fighting when I think we should be able to expect that our government can at least stay functioning. But we've got some interesting announcements. It sounds like our state is saying that we won't close our national parks, which is something that could also be impacted.
Well, that's one of the things. We don't really get to say that. But in essence, in the past, what we've said to the federal government is there, it's so important for us to keep those national parks open, especially through the tourism season in the fall. We will pay you to keep those parks open. And so I wish that we would rather operate the parks ourselves.
Yeah.
Rather than being beholden to the federal government and be at their, you know, whims of whatever they choose to do. I would rather that we ran them ourselves.
Yeah. So I think our national parks are a really great, truly great American idea. And I think that having them nationalized does make some sense to me. Of course, I would love to see them appropriately funded and managed, which they have been underfunded for a long time.
You mentioned some of the lines and delays and other things like that. And a lot of folks are going, it's just too painful to go to these parks anymore.
Yeah, it's worth it. I mean, what is family vacation if you're not yelling at each other over the stress of being in a long parking lot?
There you go.
So, do you have a favorite national park?
Do I have a favorite national park?
Yeah.
I think I'll go with the traditional Zion.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm a Theodore Roosevelt National Park kind of girl.
Oh.
So,
are you saying you're picking one outside the state?
You bet I am. I'm picking the only one in North Dakota.
Okay, then the other one I like is Yellowstone, because that's where I spent my honeymoon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel like Tetons really brings it too. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was great to see it kind of coming back.
Coming back. So let me ask this. You mentioned Chris Stewart leaving the house, but not
leaving the swamp, but not leaving the swamp.
Not leaving the swamp. Taking up new residence in a different corner of the swamp. What is the news about Chris Stewart and what's happening there?
So my understanding is Chris Stewart announced that he literally days after he left the house and resigned, he's opening up a lobbying shop there in D.C., so
yeah,
K Street kind of dynamic. My understanding is he's got restrictions that he can't lobby his colleagues in the Congress, or maybe it's just the House, for a one-year period of time. But clearly he can lobby other folks in the administration.
Yeah. So I think this is what, you know, this is kind of actually all part of a broader theme where I feel I personally have, and I think listeners, generally people in this country, have a lot of frustration with what they see in Washington, right? We understand that these are difficult jobs. We hope that people are doing them in this greater sense of public service. But then we also see this sort of unbelievable role of money in politics and thinking about the lobbying games and how this sort of system just kind of continues to feed itself. So I will say, I think we remember that he said that he had left his seat because of his wife's health. I hope she's doing better, or that it at least creates a greater opportunity for him to have more flexibility to be with his family. That I'm sure that's frustrating and can be scary depending on what's going on. So turning away from our former, at this point, Representative Chris Stewart and into some other news out of, I guess, national news, I'd love to talk a little bit about what you're seeing with the union strikes. So, or did you want to go somewhere else, John?
Well, no, we can talk. I was just going to ask you, how many gold bars do you have stashed in your house?
Oh, yeah, this is a great question.
Before we leave fully D.C.
You know, I don't know, but what I like to do is Google how much exactly one is worth my phone. Yeah. So Bob Menendez, a Democrat in the Senate from New Jersey, been in Congress for 30 years, is now going through another, I should say, this is not his first legal scandal. So he has been indicted. And there is a lot of really damning information in the indictment about behavior, which basically involves him taking the accusation is that he is taking bribes from an Egyptian foreign national to provide access to or information, potentially. I guess all of this is TBD. He had been in a very powerful seat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has stepped down from that. I'm personally of the belief that I'm sure he's not taking, you know, my opinion in count, but he should resign.
He didn't call you up this weekend?
He should absolutely resign from the seat. I think it is damning. The indictment is very concerning. And I do think that he's not serving our party well. And I think it's very questionable behavior at the very least. What do you think?
Well, and before, while he was technically cleared, he was still, I believe, censured by his colleagues in the Senate who chastised him for his previous actions. And this one just sounds even more egregious. And literally, it sounds like he started doing this like days after he was, quote unquote, cleared from the previous one.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This sounds, unfortunately, like business as usual. And then he's trying to throw out, you know, discrimination and racism and stuff, that as a Cuban American, the Hispanic people are coming after him and stuff like that. But when you look at the allegations and the concerns, you know, for those of us that aren't, you know, that familiar with New Jersey, it just sounds like New Jersey politics.
But that
potentially drops a seat in the Senate, which is already really close.
Close. That's right. But I think the bigger question is, right, do we believe that there's certain behavior that suggests that people are unfit to serve? I think this certainly falls into that category, similarly as I believe about the indictments against Donald Trump. I think that we should hold people accountable similarly, and I would love to see him step away from the seat. Okay, so we just have a minute left. Do you think we can really quickly touch on what's happening? Let's maybe skip the auto workers, come back to that, and talk really briefly that we might see a deal with a writer's strike. So we've got a writer's and an actor's strike happening. What do you think?
So it sounds like the writer's strike, they're going to come to a deal there, but you know, it's a little hard to just write when you have nobody to act for you. So it's there's a a 1-2 punch going on, and okay, they may get off and start working again, but there's still going to be a lag between that and the production.
Right.
Now, one of the things I wonder about is how much in society has really cared about those strikes. To what extent do they just look as it's the privileged elite down in Hollywood and whatever is whatever.
Yeah. So what we know is that there are millions of dollars that are generated, even here in Utah, off of the film industry. And when you think about certainly writers and we think about actors, but what goes into actually making these productions? We have people who are catering, who are bringing food, who are doing props, who are managing sets, who are scouting locations. Some of those people work right here in Utah, right? And so we know that the ripple effect out from the writer's strike is actually costing. I think now there were 3 productions in New York that are now up over $1 billion in costs that lost revenue back to the communities, right? So we know that this has a huge impact. A lot of people actually work in this space. What I'm happy to see is that hopefully we're getting to a place where people's creative work is being given the due that it deserves. We know that these streaming companies and online kind of platforms are really not being transparent or having the same kind of residuals that were negotiated before. Writers are often kind of brought in to clean up AI as opposed to really using that creativity of those individuals to drive scripts and things like that. So I think that their demands are quite reasonable. And when we're seeing record profits in this industry, I would love to see workers get more of that.
Well, and Shireen, there seemed to be a decline in unions, you know, in the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s, and now we seem to have a resurgence. So when we come back from break, I'd like to know your thoughts on why we're seeing a resurgence.
All right. Sounds good. Well, you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Shireen Ghorbani, joined by John Dougal, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Ghorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right. And you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Shireen, right before break, I mentioned that it seems to me that there's a resurgent in union activity. You talked about the writer strike, the actor's strike. We've got the UAW
United strike, Auto Workers, yep.
Against Ford, GM, and what I like to call Chrysler, but it's
Stellantis,
under a different Stellantis. Yeah, sounds more like a medication. But so there seems to be kind of a resurgent in union activity and stuff like that. What is your perspective, and what do you think is driving that?
Yeah, so my perspective is, you know, when we see the increase in, the wealth gap in our country, when we're seeing record-breaking profits in certain industries, workers, it's really easy for workers, in particular auto workers, to look at that gap between really a resurgence in American car making and, like I said, record profits for those companies, and to look and see, hey, we haven't been seeing a fair shake here. And in fact, what we know is that there are many ways in which the auto industry kind of gets around paying fair wages. They have, contract workers come in that they don't bring into the unions. We know that auto workers often work very long hours to meet the demands. And they, during the bailout, so this kind of goes back, but like specifically tied to the auto industry, when there was the big bailout in, what was that, 2008-09? Of the auto industry.
Which bailout?
Yeah, right. But the workers said, yeah, we'll participate. We're not going to take cost of living increases. We're willing to help get us back on track. And now that you're back in shape, and many of those decisions that led to that bailout were poor management decisions, not issues with workers. So
I would say it's issues on both sides.
Okay. That was widely, it's widely believed there were major management issues when that bailout happened. And workers came to the table and said, we will do what we can to get things back on track. And they really did take a cut. And when they took that, the idea was, I think, it would be reasonable to expect that you would be made whole if the company starts doing well again. And frankly, they haven't been. So I believe that workers are starting to see when they organize, when they are asking to be paid what they are worth, that that is really, you know, good for localized economies and for families across this country. And frankly, Joe Biden is our most pro-union president that we've had in decades. So I think that there's a sort of a broader sense in the community and in the country that unions help protect workers and workers need protections.
To what extent is this, you know, just kind of a backlash, and is it going to swing back? Because if you look in, from my perspective, late 70s, 80s, you know, if we pick auto workers and car manufacturers, you had a situation where, you know, Japanese car manufacturers and others were coming in and eating their cake. I mean, just able to have a better cost structure, other things like that. And the compensation that was built in for the union workers was such that it just made it very uncompetitive to be an auto manufacturer. Now, I get the dynamic that you're saying, but it seems like to some extent, why didn't we put in something that was a little better in terms of a profit-sharing arrangement with employees rather than locking in certain fixed wages and other dynamics? When a guy like me hears that the unions had negotiated previously, we're going to let a bunch of these workers that no longer have a job still get paid to be on the books, to just sit around year after year after year in the quote-unquote job bank, even though the sector is shifting away. That just sounds wasteful.
Yeah. So I don't think, I mean, I would feel really uncomfortable categorizing people as kind of sitting back. I think auto workers, we know in particular, work long hours, work really hard. And the auto industry is a place where really the middle class of America was built. And I think that we're seeing a harder and harder time for people across this country to find themselves in a comfortable middle class position, to find a good working job that provides good benefits, that allows them to retire. Those things are becoming further and further away, kind of a distant you know, dream in what used to be the hardcore American dream is now very out of reach for a lot of people. And unions really built that possibility for a lot of people. Now, when you say profit sharing, I'm interested in that. I mean, let's go in that direction if you want these businesses to make those kinds of arrangements. But I also think what we have to understand is that when CEOs are getting 40% increases year over year, that does not sit well with workers who cannot buy the cars that they are making at those factories. There's something out of balance here. And I would love to see workers get a better and a fair deal.
Yeah. And I get this is a negotiation, but right now when you hear they want a 40% pay raise,
yeah,
and they want to go down to 32 hours a week for work rather than 40. I mean, even my neighbor who's a hardcore union guy just goes, what kind of fantasy land are they living
okay,
in?
Okay, but you got to bring things to the table you're willing to walk away from, okay? So you do bring a lot when you're asking for these changes. But again, we know that these people are often working overtime. They're working double shifts. That's really pretty common for auto workers. So really getting a fair structure in place, I think, is important. And I do think it's good for our national security. It's good for Americans.
Is this the resurgence of Detroit or the death knell in Detroit? That will be a question from my perspective.
I love Detroit. That's a city on the move. Okay, so let's say turning from
there. Is it going up or going down?
Well, we've got,
it's on the move.
It's rising. Their whole hashtag, opportunity rising. So moving from there, let's talk a little bit about what's happening we've got a president joining the picket line for the first time in a very long time. I'm not sure I guess it has happened before, but it's been decades. So we have President Biden showing up and Trump is also showing up.
He's going to skip the debate and go speak to the union workers. My understanding is the union boss of the UAW is holding his powder dry in terms of who he wants the union to back for president.
Yeah. So it's very common for candidates to appear on picket lines. It's very unusual for a president to do this. But again, you know, Biden is really our most pro-union president that we've had in decades. So I do think it's an appropriate fit.
This is a flashback to the 70s economy.
What I find hilarious is that Trump, who is on the record as being deeply anti-union and in fact says we should take these jobs and ship them to China, which is a curious position to take given the larger geopolitical context of that. Trump is also showing up and skipping the debate. But what should we expect to see? I guess we can talk about it next week. But what do you think about skipping the debate to go be with the auto
workers? So we are recording before the debate. But one of the interesting things is Trump, you know, for whatever reason, you know, he's afraid to debate. And I think that doesn't bode well for him. I think we've seen his popularity decline as a result of not showing up on stage. I know there's going to be some hard questions that he'd have to answer if he were there. It will be interesting. Ron DeSantis did not do well in the previous debate. Will he step up and do better this time? Nikki Haley did quite well. I think she was one of the winners in the last debate. Mm-hmm. Will she have another solid performance or not? What does Ramaswamy do?
Yeah.
And stuff like that. I think he did what he needed to do, but is there more substance there? And you're going to see, for example, Asa Hutchinson, my understanding, is dropping off, did not make the cut for the second round. Mm. The other folks that were in the first debate did make the cut, so we'll have to see what shakes out.
Yeah, so we're expecting seven people on stage. And I wonder, you know, if this kind of core question about what is happening more broadly in our democracy is going to be on the table. So we had our governor, Governor Cox, really reacting to some of the details that came out in the Mitt Romney piece that was in The Atlantic, which is going to be the McKay-Coppin biography that was written about him, talking about the amount that he spends, about $5,000, it sounded like a month.
$5,000 a week.
Since January 6th, on his private security. We know most people certainly can't afford that, but that there's a real sense of, you know, increasing violence and not just rhetoric, but also action in our country. And he said, you know, his quote was, look, I'm not usually prone to hyperbole, but we're headed down a very dark path. And we're further down that path than I think most people realize. I think that our governor is right. There are some recent examples I would point to, but quick reaction from you on those comments.
Yeah. First of all, it's we have lost the ability to debate in a rational sense. The rhetoric, the violence, the threats of violence, it doesn't matter who you are. It seems to have escalated significantly. You know, Mitt Romney clearly has the resources that he can afford to pay for security. Your average Joe does not.
Yeah.
And no matter what kind of fundraising you do in D.C. or in the state, the typical politician has no way to be able to fund that kind of security detail. Now, our governor clearly has security provided by the state.
But when you talk about the average Joe, I want to make that even more specific. We're seeing record numbers of county clerks resigning, not running for re-election across the West, across the United States, people who don't want to run for school board, people who are staying out of elected office or even thinking about it.
I'm just the auditor, and I've got veiled death threats. Yeah. My blood will flow in the streets and other things like that for things I've said and done in the past.
Right. So this is certainly increasing, but it is rippling outside of, kind of the political or public service sphere into, very concrete threats. Just this week, over the weekend, there was a bomb threat that canceled a Drag Times story hour that was scheduled at the King's English Bookshop. This I find enraging at a level that it's difficult for me to even talk about. I'm a person who takes my kid to family-friendly drag events. I love drag queens. I love the King's English Bookstore, one of our jewels in our independent bookstores across this county. For me, I just have to say, I hope that we're seeing incredible transparency. My understanding is that this threat was similar to two others that happened across the country. There was one in New York City and one in New Haven, Connecticut, that was quite similar to what happened here in Salt Lake City. But I hope our police are working really quickly to let us know if this is a localized threat or if this is something that was organized. Sometimes national groups will organize things like this. But we deserve to know who are local actors. And I hope that we know as soon as possible to understand the level of threat and how present that may be in our community.
Well, if you don't like it, fine, go protest.
Right.
Show up, stand up, protest.
Okay,
don't just phone in some threat.
I mean, yes. And I will say bomb threats are terrorism, right? Like that is a terroristic threat. But we also had people showing up to protest at Tizanti that happened earlier this year. They came armed. So when people show up to protest to these things and they're exacting this level of threat, I think that this is exactly what our governor is talking about, that we have slipped into a hysteria. But to me, it's also frustrating because I see in our state, you know, actions that to me are a direct link. When we see, for example, there was a story this week that we have a doctor tied to anti-LGBTQ hate groups who is now going to serve on Utah's Trans Sports Commission. This is exactly how this kind of stuff gets institutionalized and a permission structure exists for it to escalate. I'm frustrated that we have somebody from out of state who is known to have these ties to these groups being asked to come and serve on something in-state when we do have experts here in our own valley on LGBTQ health on both sides of this issue. It is deeply frustrating to me that we're seeing this entrenched in our politics and that a permission structure to allow that to go forward is underway.
Well, and if we can't engage like we do to talk, passionately yet respectfully, that does not bode well for our country, does not bode well for our state.
No, that's right.
You know, when people talk about disagree better, it's easy to just pay lip service to disagree better, but you actually have to step up and engage.
Yeah.
And you have to model the behavior that you expect from folks.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean just shutting up. It means passionately sharing your perspective and your insights.
Well, sometimes I grip the table and sweat and want to scream, but I do have to say, I think that there is something important about the exercise of coming back week after week. And if people have the opportunity to find a place where they can start and engage in this conversation in their community, you're going to be carrying forward something that I know that we really value on this show, that we value at this station. And I really would just ask people to continue to speak up and use your voices, hopefully towards building a better future.
This has been John Dougal and Shireen Gabbani. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Thanks to our producer, Anthony Scoma.